This time on Gamers Week podcast.
And there's always a way around a different IP address. Oh, yeah, you could contact your ISP and say, hey, just for whatever in Griggles, can I get a new IP address? And they say, okay.
Right. No reason, just another new IP address. This is your fourth one.
Right. I want to start fresh. What can I say?
Reminds me of that scene in the movie Don't Be a Menace, where he's like, don't ask no questions.
I'll tell you no lies.
Yeah, basically.
Well, I am ready.
I am ready. I got my Bud Light Seltzer here.
Oh, how fancy.
Cherry Limeade and Twisted Berry.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Gamers Week podcast. Like the name says, we analyze the best, the worst, and the weirdest headlines of the past week in the video game industry. This is episode 4, and today is Wednesday, January 12th, 2022. Frick. I've done so well all year. 2022. I hope everybody knows what year it is. All right.
You're still writing 2021 on your checks, aren't you?
Actually, I did have to write a check this week. It was so weird. Hello, everyone. My name is Blue Williams. I will be your host for this evening, and I am here with my two wonderful co-hosts. I have Ryan Payne, a.k.a. Retro Game Brews, and the one and only Donnie G. How are you guys?
I'm doing great.
Excellent. And you hear that? It's the one and only. There's not another one.
No, there is not.
There are several of me, by the way.
Ryan is a dime a dozen, but there's a one and only Donnie G, and we have him here. All right. Today's episode is proudly sponsored by the Retro Game Club podcast, and we will tell you more about them in just a little bit. But first, everybody knows that we launched our podcast last Friday, and it was crazy. Like, I don't know how else to describe it. It was freaking crazy, right?
Nuts.
Absolutely nuts.
We were not expecting, like, in any way, shape, or form, the wonderful response, all the encouragement, all the messages, all the congratulations that we got. It was insane. So we want to share a couple of highlights of our week. We want to send out some thank yous to some people, and then we will get on with the show. So first off, here were some of our highlights of our week. We had over 400 downloads just in our first week. Now, that may not sound like a lot to you, but before we started, we were like, gosh, we hope we get 50 downloads. I mean, those of you who have started a podcast know how hard it is to start a brand new podcast completely from scratch. And we weren't expecting much. And then we were just so grateful and thrilled to see how many people were interested in hearing what we had to say. We had so many shout outs and messages that for a brief shining moment, we were actually trending on Twitter. How nuts is that?
We were trending. We were trending
maybe for like 10 minutes, but it was there. We have photographic proof.
It's something.
It's something. And then finally, Leroy Patterson, the Sneak King collecting wrestler, said that if we ever want him on the podcast, he'd be happy to pop in.
Which we will definitely take you up on.
We would totally take him up because we want to hear all about those 2,706 Sneak Kings in your collection.
Don't forget the six. Don't forget the six.
The six is very important.
So we also got a ton of feedback on the show, and there's way too many comments to share them all. But here are kind of a few of them that stuck out to us. So first of all, from Steve Rangel, said, finishing up the first episode of Gamers Week podcast, and I'm looking forward to future episodes. Loving everything about it. Go check it out if you haven't already. Thank you, Steve. That is awesome.
Thank you, Steve.
Yes. Next up from Cadis is awesome job, easily a top five podcast for me without a doubt, which first week, that's saying something.
Right?
So that's not bad. I'll take it.
Right. Next up from Spexy is nice podcast. You guys seem to have the right balance of informative and fun. You sound like you're a bunch of cool, nerdy, and in parentheses, yes, you can be both. Friends, having a good laugh, chatting about the Gameverse. Good work and keep it up. From Fatal Vision, these guys nailed it. Want to see a gaming podcast done right? Look no further. Can't disagree with you there. Fatal Vision. And lastly, from Doongi Forever, I never found a video game podcast I liked till this one. I love the hosts, and just overall, it's a great show. I'll be listening to this when I'm level grinding in my RPGs. Nice. So we are happy.
Aw, shucks.
Yeah. So we're also getting a ton of compliments on our theme, which is admittedly lit. Can't disagree with that. So what we wanted to do is give a special shout out to our composer, which, by the way, he is from Finland. So if I mispronounce this, I apologize. Aksiseli Takanen. I tried. I apologize.
We tried.
Yep, we did. If you want to check out more of his work, you can visit him at A-K-S-E-T-A-K-A on Twitter or follow the link in the show notes.
And just to let you guys know, we didn't have to pay anybody for those nice reviews.
No. That's right.
Is that a thing people do?
I think so.
Okay.
If you're running a mattress company.
Say it soft. And finally, we need to say thank you to two wonderful podcasts who shared our launch with their audiences. New Dad Gaming, a show about dads figuring out their gaming lives. And each week, Trevor and Jeff walk through their experiences both as fathers and gamers. With precious limited time for gaming, they talk about what games they're playing and what fatherhood has thrown at them this week. These are great guys. And we can confirm that you don't need to be a dad to enjoy their show. Visit newdadgaming.com to check them out. And I only wish this podcast was around about 10 years ago whenever I became a new dad and was still a gamer. We also want to thank A Gamer Looks at 40. A Gamer Looks at 40 is a podcast exploration of the history of video games as told from the recollections and stories of the everyday people who lived it. Bill Tucker decided to celebrate his 40th birthday by looking back at his life through the lens of the games he has loved. This show is a fun nostalgia trip you should definitely check out. You can find Bill on Twitter at A Gamer Looks at 40.
And I was actually on the most recent show, so definitely check that out.
How did that go?
I listened to it. He got called a rabble rouser.
I did, but wow. He's not wrong. He's not wrong.
I don't know about that, but I'll defer to Bill, I guess, on the matter. It's his show. All right, so I know we've kind of been going on and on about it, but really, we are just overwhelmed and humbled by the response to the show. We can't thank everyone enough for their kind words. And we really, really hope that we can continue to provide a fun show for you all for a really long time to come, because we're having a blast doing it. And to know that people are enjoying what we're doing makes it even that much better.
For sure. Agreed. I mean, it's not always easy to kind of put ourselves out there, and the response that we've got really provides us with motivation to keep going. So thank you all. Mm-hmm.
All right, now let's get into the meat of the show, and it is now time for the very important poll. Every Monday on Twitter, we post our VIP, that is a very important poll. And if you'd like to participate, be sure to follow us on Twitter at GamersWeekPC. So our question this week was, what is your favorite fighting game franchise that is not Street Fighter or Mortal Kombat? Our choices were, in third place, Soul Calibur with 22.5% of the vote. Super Smash Brothers came in second with 27.3% of the vote. And Tekken was the winner of the day with 31.2% of the vote. We also had 12% of people voted other. And so let's take a look at some of their answers. At BlazeKnight0923 said, Injustice is hands down the best non-Mortal Kombat fighting game series, as it's made by the same developer. It's the DC Comics universe fighting game I never knew I wanted. Plus, you get some awesome guest characters like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. At SMB Flurry says, King of Fighters. There are so many great Neo Geo fighters like Fatal Fury, Samurai Showdown, and Last Blade. At Madman2170 says, Marvel versus Capcom. I love that series way more than both Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat, and that's because it's a series that cemented my love for the fighting game genre. It's literally the only fighting game where I love to just discover things for myself. At Bogus Meat Factor says, Virtua Fighter is the jazz of fighting games. You play at the rhythm and pace custom to you, and it's a complex art form a lot of folks refuse to understand. It is the best without question. And finally, at Ants May Be Cool says, Grand Blue Fantasy Versus. It's a very easy fighting game to get into. Anyone can throw a fireball, even my mom.
Hey, mom, give me a Hadouken.
I love that.
I was like, maybe I need to look up that one. So, right. Donnie, how did you answer?
So my first answer was going to be Virtual Fighter. Even though I picked Tekken, for me, it was Virtual Fighter. And so my recollection back from the early days of the arcade is that Mortal Kombat came out first, 92. Mortal Kombat 2 came out in 93. And right after that, Virtual Fighter jumped onto the scene. And it was one of the very first fighting games that I noticed that had the run feature where you could actually mm-hmm. sprint at your opponent. And I just remember it was one of the first polygonal or polygonal, however you pronounce that word. I don't want people to think I'm stupid, but it's okay, Donnie. We already do.
You said it, not me.
From my own mouth. It was one of the very first polygonal fighting games around, and it was very different than what we were used to as far as the Mortal Kombat craze with the live motion capture. So you had Street Fighter with its 2D sprites, you had Mortal Kombat with its motion capture, and then now you have Virtual Fighter, which was like the kind of like very first 3D fighting game. I spent a lot of time on Virtual Fighter aside from Mortal Kombat and Mortal Kombat 2. And then when Tekken came along, Tekken kind of took over because it had a more in-depth storyline. They really created the universe of Tekken, right. Got behind the characters and whatnot that they kind of didn't really do with Virtual Fighter. So I'm sticking with Virtual Fighter over Tekken.
Mm. I love Virtual Fighter. I remember going to the arcade and being like, wow, look at this. It's in 3D. And right. the whole map actually, you know, spins around and caters to your movements and stuff. That was such an advance as far as gaming was concerned. And I remember people piling around watching that game when, you know, how mm-hmm. Mortal Kombat was when it first came out, where everybody was putting yep. a quarter up. Virtual Fighter was like that nice second game that everybody wanted to play.
Mm-hmm. The old I got next.
Yep.
And my quarter was the fourth one. No, mine was the fourth one.
right. It was such a daunting task trying to keep eyes on your quarter. And if you stepped away from that machine even for a split second, you were in the risk of somebody just taking your quarter and be like, okay, it's my turn. You're like, where's mine?
You're not going to go get a soda. You're not going to go to the restroom. You put your quarter down and you are committed. You stay there.
Right. Might as well pee in your pants.
There you go.
I was like, why didn't we bring like a Sharpie?
Priorities.
Nobody thought of that.
I guess not. What was your answer, Ryan?
So this one was a recent discovery of mine. I had been doing some research for games for an RGB high score for the Genesis. So I had an EverDrive cart of all of the Sega Genesis as well as Mega Drive games. Started this one up to see how it played, and I found myself playing this game for about 2 hours. I didn't even realize it until I was about 2 hours in. But that is Samurai Showdown.
Great game.
What a great take on the fighting game genre to, instead of making it something that's a little bit more futuristic and modern, they took it back to feudal Japan, where, of course, you're a samurai. You've got a whole bunch of different weapons, a lot of gore and blood. So that was in there. So that I'm sure I would have loved as a kid. So, but just a really fun game. The controls are really tight. And I know that they've gotten a few different renditions. I think they're up to 5. And then they recently, last June, came out with a compilation version of it as well. So it's still out there and it's still popular. And my goodness, it's a lot of fun.
I can't confirm.
I have like a bargain basement EverDrive. I should see if it's on there because I don't.
There you go.
Did you get that at Big Lots?
I got it for Christmas. My sister's like, hey, I know you like, she doesn't know any better. She's like, I know you like video games. So here's one of those like 999 games in one cards.
I gotcha.
So I'm like, thank you. The thought that counts. But I'll see if it's on there because I don't think I've spent any significant time with it. So.
Oh, you definitely got to check it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Blue, what was your choice?
My choice was Tekken. I'm not the biggest fighting game fan ever. I, to be honest, I really completely suck at them. I'm so bad at them. I love Mortal Kombat. Mortal Kombat is like the coolest series ever. Even when I was a kid, like when it first came out, and I remember looking at the kids who could play Mortal Kombat and just being like, oh my God, it's so cool. And I just can't do it. I'm so bad at it. But for some reason, I can play Tekken. So I don't know why. Maybe Tekken's just a bit easier. I don't know enough about the mechanics to tell you why I can play Tekken and not Mortal Kombat, but freaking heck, I will take it.
So let me tell you a little story. Every year around Christmas or Thanksgiving, when we have family over or we go down to see my wife's family, we have a Tekken tournament.
Okay.
No kidding. You guys, that's awesome. Yeah.
It's a Tekken tournament.
The whole family?
Well, my wife's family. So like her brother, her brothers, their spouses, their kids and whatnot. We all get together and we just play Tekken.
Mom and dad don't?
The mom and dad do not. They don't partake in Tekken. They sit there and watch and have a good time.
I was just envisioning grandma being like, take that.
Exactly. But my wife will sit there. So we've played Tekken ever since we were dating when I would bring my PlayStation over to her house. And she would pick Eddie Gordo. And
it's easy to spam Eddie's moves.
It is so easy, and you would not believe how upset and pissed off I would get when I would lose because she just constantly spammed the same button. He's doing his little breakdancing disco moves
you
on the floor.
I can't
get up.
Nope.
No, couldn't do anything. So over the years, I've grown more knowledgeable and more seasoned with Tekken to where I can fend off her attacks and just like kind of look over and say, you're messing with the best, son. What are you going to do? And then the entire family, it's their goal to try and take me down from my throne.
Love that. That is awesome.
Yeah. I can't wait till next Christmas. You'll have to update us on how it went.
Yes. Absolutely.
Do you guys have like a trophy that you hand off every single year for the winner?
No, but that's a good idea. But then again, I'd be the one carrying the trophy every single year. So,
what you should do is get a trophy for the worst, like a exactly. Like a toilet trophy.
Yes, absolutely.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks everyone who voted. And again, be sure to follow us on Twitter at GamersWeekPC. And we will be posting our next very important poll on Monday. So if you want to participate, you can check it out. And now it's time to thank our wonderful patrons. So Ryan, cue the music.
So you wouldn't think a brand new podcast would already have patrons, and frankly, no one is more surprised than us. Here are the generous folks supporting Gamers Week on Patreon. So we have 4 new patrons to announce.
Wow.
Yes, I know, right?
Holla.
So our first patron is RedoxPDX. And by the way, special greetings to Shannon and Luke, who also listen to the show. And we've been told are fans of the show. So thank you guys for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Zach, huge thanks. Random Retro Dude and Mikhail Lundin join Princess Kitty Mew Mew, Mega Retro Man, Emo-esque, Rye Bread's number one fan, and Fruitcake's number one stan, The Wizard of Zardoz, Flamin 71, Great Saiyaman 81, BNT Zilla Guy, Crunchy Kong, Sheriff Snacks, Frank Grande, Producer BTW, Ducks in Disguise, Games with Coffee, and Davey PGH. If you like what you hear today, and we really hope that you do, please consider joining us on Patreon. Your support helps cover the cost of producing the show, as well as other cool stuff we'll be doing like prizes and giveaways. Visit patreon.com/gamersweek or follow the link in the show notes to learn more.
All right, let's move on to our headlines for the evening.
First up, from Game Informer, Sega opens new studio led by former Phantasy Star 2 Online 2 producer. What did I tell you? Sega's coming back.
You said hardware.
Yeah, I know. But this is, it's baby steps, baby steps.
As soon as I saw this headline, I was like, Johnny was right. Oh, my God.
He was not right yet.
It's going to happen.
What are the winning lottery numbers? So Sega has announced that it has established a new studio called Sega Sapporo Studio. This studio was formally created on December 1st, 2021 as a second development base in Japan, as first reported by Gematsu. Sapporo was established to focus on new software development and debugging. It will be led by former Phantasy Star Online 2 chief producer Takaya Sagawa, who was promoted to a senior corporate position for Sega in April of last year. As the name suggests, Sapporo is located in the city of Sapporo, and the studio will hire locally to build a staff dedicated to designing, programming, and debugging game software. As expected with the creation of a new studio, Sapporo already has a website, which can be viewed here. VGC notes that Sega has multiple in-house development studios like Sonic Team and Ryuga Gotoku Studio, makers of titles like Yakuza and Judgment, but that they all work out of Sega's main development base in Tokyo. Sapporo will serve as another development base akin to the original.
So, Sega has opened yet another development house. While I'm not sure that this points to the hardware that Donnie was wishfully hoping for.
It's baby steps.
Baby steps. It probably means that they're going to increase their game output, which could be cool.
I hope so, because this is just a game debugging studio. So I'm assuming they'll get titles in that they're responsible for, you know, testing and debugging and whatnot. But maybe this is all the guise of building up your own in-house talent. So they can identify certain things and get better at building a specific type of game, and then all of a sudden this is going to switch to something else to where they'll actually be putting out their own titles. Mm-hmm. But who knows?
So dream scenario: what are the Sega titles that you would love to see Sega release for a modern console?
I don't know. That's a loaded question. I mean I can't really answer that question right now, because do I want something new? Absolutely. Do I want something old from their countless titles in their library? Yes. A million times yes. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's a very good question. I can't answer that right now.
I like how his voice keeps going in and out because he's looking right over at his shelves to try to see what to say, and then it comes back.
So I will go then first, if that makes it easier for
sure.
You. So I would love another Phantasy Star Online. I think that would be awesome to bring that back. As I understand, that community is still very vibrant online. So I would love to see another edition of that. I'd also like to see some old titles. Like, for example, bring out another Gunstar Heroes. That would be awesome.
Ooh, there you go. Yeah.
Yep. And if they could bring like a remastered version of the Genesis, and I guess it was also on Super Nintendo. Probably Super Nintendo was the better version of it, but fix all the issues that was with the Sega version, Sunset Riders, bring another Sunset Riders. I would love that.
The Super Nintendo is the de facto standard for the Sunset Riders.
Sure.
I do have the Sega Genesis version. I have yet to try it out. I know that's kind of, people are like, what, you have that game and you haven't played it? Yes, I have a ton of games that I haven't played that I've just received in collections that I've bought and whatnot. It's taking some time.
And then Mutant League Football.
Yes.
Mutant League Hockey. I know that they have released recent versions of that, but I'd love an official release from Sega. I think it would be cool.
Like, I still haven't played the newer version of Toe Jam and Earl that came out a couple years ago.
Oh.
Yeah, I still haven't played that either. I've wanted to, but I still haven't.
But they've got
an amazing... Oh, did you? Mm-hmm. How was it?
I feel like some of the magic was gone.
Gotcha.
But if you like the first one, you'll probably like this one.
Good to know.
So it's more like the first one rather than the second one with Planet Funkatron or whatever it was?
Right.
Funkatron.
Yeah, it's the same thing where you play the different levels of Earth looking for your spaceship, except for there's all new kinds of presents that you can get, all new kinds of enemies and all that kind of stuff. It's been updated, you know, for the times, because it's not the 90s anymore, sad to say.
It's not? I sure dress like it is.
I think you just ruined Donnie's day right there.
Sorry. I know we agreed not to tell him.
Cat's out of the bag.
Yep.
What year is it?
All right, next up from GameSpot, Xbox boss Phil Spencer calls for cross-platform ban program. Xbox boss, that is such a difficult tongue twister of a phrase. Xbox boss. Right. Xbox boss. Xbox boss. Phil Spencer has revealed that Microsoft would like to help get rid of bad actors in the online gaming landscape by creating a multi-network program whereby bans that apply to Xbox, for example, might also carry over to networks from other companies. Speaking to the New York Times, Spencer acknowledged that this would be a hard one to achieve, but it's something he hopes to see someday. Something I would love us to be able to do, and this is a hard one as an industry, is when somebody gets banned in one of our networks, is there a way for us to ban them across other networks? He said. Alternatively, Spencer said he would embrace a system that allows players to bring their banned user list to them on another platform. I'd love to be able to bring them to other networks where I play. So this is the group of people that I choose not to play with, because I don't want to have to recreate that in every platform that I play video games on, he said. Also in the interview, Spencer spoke about how Microsoft uses AI on Xbox to monitor the sentiment of a conversation, to detect when a conversation is getting to a destructive point. There is also a report a user button in the Xbox UI to report bad behavior.
So are you saying that Xbox monitors our conversations?
Sounds that way. And that's actually really funny, because I've heard you guys play Call of Duty. And I'm not sure how an AI is going to know that you are not being completely abusive to one another.
Lou, you be quiet. We do not delve into secrets for Call of Duty talk. So
what happens in Warzone stays in Warzone.
Yeah, exactly. Not suitable for work.
I think this is interesting. I don't know how they could sell this for one particular user to bring their ban list, because A, the names are different. My Xbox gamer ID is different from that of my my PlayStation Network ID. So
I had that same question, actually. I don't know the answer. I just had the same question.
Right. Okay. And another thing is, how do they keep track of, so let's just say a user, are they talking about the people who actually do something nefarious or malicious, like as running a cheat program or what have you, and they get themselves banned by the company that makes the game? And how long do you ban this person for? Because let's just say it's some young kid who just wants to show off or impress some people and whatnot. He's like, oh, look, I'm the best COD player around, but he's using a cheat program. He gets banned. Would you want to give that person a chance at redemption later on in life instead of having them permabanned?
That's a great question. And one of the other things that I was thinking about too about this is, from the perspective of being able to accomplish this, in order to do that, you would need every single company who's utilizing this cross-platform ban to have the same rules and policies. Right. And because if you're going to ban it for one thing that's not against the rules on another one, you're going to run into a lot of trouble with that. And the only way I can think of as well is if for banning somebody with different usernames is to ban their IP, which means that everyone in that household would also be potentially banned if somebody did something. So if you got like a hothead little brother, that would suck.
Ruining it for everyone.
Right.
Right.
So that's the only solution. So, I mean, there's obviously a lot of unintended consequences for doing this, but I get the sentiment. I get the desire to want to make this a better gaming community, to remove some of that toxicity that people are trying to avoid. But it would be far too difficult to try to figure that out. Especially, you know, with the different naming conventions that you'd see between platforms.
And there's always a way around a different IP address. Oh, yeah, you could contact your ISP and say, hey, just for whatever and giggles, like, can I get a new IP address? And they say, okay.
Right. No reason, just another new IP address. This is your fourth one.
Right. I want to start fresh. What can I say?
Reminds me of that scene in the movie Don't Be a Menace, where he's like, don't ask no questions.
I'll tell you no lies.
Yeah, basically.
But I agree with the desire for this. I think that, again, at the end of the day, making every single effort to try to remove some of the bad experiences that people have run into because of people working nefariously. And what sounds like to me is that his focus is the behavior piece to it. Because at the end, he was talking about the fact that it can, you know, the UI can detect if something is getting to a destructive point. That also brings up a crap ton of subjectivity, though. So you would have to have some really hard rules. You would have to have some really hard examples of policies and procedures, and all of those companies would have to agree upon them.
Well, it could be something like how you can randomly get your YouTube channel banned, or you can lose your Twitter account. Almost every day I'm hearing about somebody who has had, or some company or somebody who's had their YouTube account shut down, frozen, whatever, for some sort of violation. And because it's an automated process that does it, they can never get an answer on what it is that they've done.
Right,
they never have an opportunity to remedy it. You know, it's going to be a give and take if this is the direction, like if the Xbox community, and I'm going to guess a large part of it is also the first person shooter community, cares so much about stomping out cheaters at any cost, then maybe that is perfectly acceptable. Those kind of casualties are perfectly acceptable to that community. I don't know. I'm not part of it. So
right.
All right, next up from The Verge, why Take-Two wants to pay nearly $13 billion, that's billion with a B, for the maker of Farmville. So Take-Two Interactive just announced its intent to buy Farmville developer Zynga for $12.7 billion in what could be the biggest acquisition in video game history. It's an absolutely massive deal. To put into perspective, the acquisition would be $5 billion more than Microsoft's $7.5 billion purchase of the parent company of Skyrim maker Bethesda Softworks. You can throw in the money Disney paid for Lucasfilms and still have cash left over. Wow.
That really does put it in perspective. Holy crap.
Right. So what is Take-Two getting its money for? Yes, big Zynga games like Farmville, Words with Friends, and High Heels will join Take-Two's own roster of franchises that include Grand Theft Auto, NBA 2K, and Civilization. But perhaps more importantly, Take-Two will now be able to use Zynga's expertise building hugely popular free-to-play mobile titles so it can make a new hit games based on its own property. In fact, Zynga will be the new brand for the Take-Two mobile efforts. Current Zynga CEO Frank Gibeau will lead that organization, indicating the potential direction of Take-Two's mobile future. The deal isn't just about turning Take-Two's games into mobile hits. Take-Two highlighted how its expertise in console PC can be applied to Zynga's crossplay ambitions. Zynga is set to put its toe into the console gaming with Star Wars Hunters, which is coming to Nintendo Switch, iOS, and Android sometime this year. Take-Two plans to use Zynga's Chart Boost ad platform to acquire new users more efficiently and optimize mobile ad inventory. And yes, there is something with NFTs in the future, Gibeau said during Monday's investor call, that the idea that players will play to earn or play to own is a very compelling idea that we think will have legs as the industry develops.
Has there ever been a more businessy, menacing sentence than acquire new users more efficiently and optimize mobile ad inventory?
No, there has not.
We talked in episode 2, I think it was, about the crazy revenue being brought in by mobile and free to play, and the fact that Take-Two is willing to put down this much money, more than the entirety of Lucasfilm, more than the entirety of Bethesda, for freaking mobile games and a mobile game maker.
It makes sense, doesn't it? But because of what we touched on in our previous episode on how much money mobile games are bringing in, this makes sense.
I mean, it does. The math checks out, even if I have a tough time wrapping my head around it.
Because we were saying that, some of the top mobile games were making upwards of $2 billion. So if we're talking they're able to add a whole bunch of extra properties as well as build some additional, I mean, we're talking a break-even point of a matter of a few years on one of the biggest deals of all time in gaming history. That is that's a promising prospect for them, for sure.
Agreed. Who plays Words with Friends still?
I do.
Oh, okay.
Which, it's funny, the only person I play against is my mother-in-law.
I mean, hey, sometimes those channels, you got to keep them open. You got to keep keep some goodwill flowing.
So she is somebody who plays to the max, right? I'm almost fairly certain, not 100% sure, but almost fairly certain that she has at least spent some money to get some of those coins and stuff that you can get with Words with Friends in order to play more games or more rounds and matches and stuff, because I will play against her and then I will go check like the friends leaderboard and she has like 30,000 points more than me.
So, oh, wow. She's climbing the ladder.
Right? And so it's impressive. She must be playing that at every moment outside of, you know, obviously when she's working. But my goodness, it's impressive to see her level of dedication to that game.
Wow. She sounds like those old ladies at bingo who have like 6 cards spread out in front of them.
Right.
She does play a bingo game too, by the way.
Of course.
From Looper.com, the video game you never knew Bob Saget was in. Rest in peace. Bob Saget was a comedy icon, and many people expressed just how devastating his death was when news of it broke on January 9th. Of course, Saget has been immortalized through his stand-up and numerous appearances in film and television, but fans may not realize he also had a place in the video game community. His solo video game role was as Barry Tuttle in the Tuttle's Madcap Misadventures. I don't think I've ever heard of this one.
Then keep reading.
Literally the next
one. If you've never... I'm ahead of my time. If you've never heard of the game, don't worry. Released back in 2007 for the PC, the game follows a family of four, with Bob Saget voicing the father of the group. While on a road trip, the titular Tuttles get completely derailed, leading to a number of wild encounters on land and under the sea. Under the sea! The single-player side-scroller controlled very similarly to classic Mario games, but it also featured some really wacky elements, like Saget's character whipping out a gas canister to attack enemies. Though relatively obscure now, the game was well received for its wholesome atmosphere and fun mechanic. In addition to the presence of Saget in solid reviews, the Tuttle's Madcap Misadventures also boasted more A-list stars and supported an excellent charity. The characters of Barbara, Jess, and Zach were voiced by Jamie Lee Curtis, Ashley Tisdale, and Dominic Scott Kay, respectively. Rounding out the group of talent is William Shatner, Dave Thomas, and Saget's Full House co-star, Dave Coulier. Cut it out. The Tuttle's Madcap Misadventures was created to raise money for Starlight Starbright Children's Foundation.
That's a fantastic thing to hear. I mean, I know that it everybody is. Was kind of devastated by the passing of Bob, myself included. That was a show. Full House was something that was a part of my childhood. And mm-hmm. Bob was the Danny Tanner character. And of course, he was the wholesome, father figure for that. Come to find out, his comedy is anything but wholesome, which also, in a way, made him enduring the fact that he could play right. such a wholesome guy on Full House and then do comedy that we can't repeat here.
Yeah, nope. We could, but...
Nope.
But Blue would have a hard time editing that.
Right, right.
There are not that many beats.
Just a lot of Mario sound pieces there. Nice. But, it's great to hear that he was involved in the gaming community and the fact that this game was intended to help out children, for a good cause. So, thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
And apparently this game is no longer available for sale, which is a shame because it would make a great stream, I think.
Absolutely. What we should do is start a Kickstarter.
To get it ported to like the Switch?
Yes, please.
Tuttle's Madcap. Let's see what eBay has.
But also Dave Thomas, William Shatner, Jamie Lee Curtis, and Dave Coulier. That sounds like an awesome game. This needs to be a thing we can play.
How did we not ever hear about this?
Right?
Bob, please get your gas canister so we can attack the enemy.
Okay.
It was a good Shatner impression. I'll give him about high five there.
Yeah, Donnie, thank you.
High five. E for effort.
Virtual high five. So if you're looking for the Tuttle's Madcap Misadventures right now, it's currently, you can find it on eBay. There are several different auctions to be had, and it doesn't look like any one of these are over $10. So
nice.
Go out, pay your respects to Bob, and pick up this game.
Yeah, grab it. I'm sure our patrons will be happy to hear that their money is going towards a Bob Saget game and that we can stream.
So one of the things, if we do Tuttle's Madcap Misadventures, we need to put on there for a reward for people during the stream, is that we all sing the theme song to Full House.
I don't know the theme song to Full House.
Everywhere you look, there's a heart, there's a what, a way to come find you. Everywhere you look.
We'll look up the lyrics, don't worry.
It's almost funnier if you don't know them.
Just make them up as you go along.
Yep. Right, right.
Get the karaoke version of it in the background so we at least have the beat right.
All right. Well, if you listened last week, you know that we have a giveaway going. So, Ryan, let us know who won the big giveaway.
Give me 1 second here while I pull up the names because I didn't actually save them on my computer.
Amateur.
Amateur, I saw.
Like you've ever run a giveaway before, geez.
Oh, shit. Where is it? I can't find the Oh, there we go. Got it. Our winners. Got it. Okay. Cool. Okay. All right, everybody. As Blue said, we were doing a giveaway here on behalf of Gamers Week Podcast. We started off on Friday, asked people to take a screenshot or a picture of them listening to one of our three episodes. And we are super excited to announce who is going to be our winner of one of our three excellent prizes, which, of course, is a Yoshi crocheted doll thing. Still haven't decided what it is. It's not an action figure. I've been told it's not an action figure, which was very popular. People loved that. We also have a repo copy of the game Earthbound Zero, which was the Famicom first mother game, which has an English translation patch to it. So you'll be able to actually read it. And then we've got a copy of the homebrew game Lizard for the NES too. So super excited to provide these prizes to you folks. We're going to be announcing it here on the podcast. So if you're listening on Friday, do us a favor. Don't like at one of the winners until they at least announce it.
Oh my God, you won!
Right, exactly. So if one of the people is like, hey, look, I won. I listened to this episode and I won. By all means, tell them congratulations. But at least wait until we announce it on Saturday. So it's out there on the public on Twitter. But here are our three winners. And the way it's going to work out is that since we have three of them, the person in first position gets the first choice, second gets second choice, and third gets third choice. So we will announce them in order. So drum roll, please. We have an aging drum roll. All right, so our third place winner is going to be Rudy Bagels. Rudy, congratulations. Our second place is going to be Wizard of Zardoz. And lastly, number one is going to be Closable 8. So congratulations, Closable. Which he had expressed yesterday that he really wanted that Yoshi crochet. So I'm assuming that's probably going to be his choice. But congratulations to you all. We are excited to really do these giveaways. It's a great opportunity for us to say thank you to the community that has provided us with so much support and feedback. So by all means, we will be doing these again. We do them pretty much on a monthly basis. So we will announce them right here on the podcast every time we are about to run a new contest. So congratulations to the winners and thank you all.
Indeed. Congrats. Congratulations to the winners. Thank you, everyone who entered. And this was fun. Let's do it again.
Definitely.
All right. Moving on. As we mentioned earlier, this episode of Gamers Week is sponsored. You heard it right, folks. We have a sponsor. And we are proud to announce the name of our new sponsor. It is Retro Game Club Podcast. They are a fantastic family-friendly retro gaming podcast. In each episode, Rob and Hugh pick two games to play and discuss. They also have news, interviews, and other special topics. One of the hosts even ran a podcast a few years ago, and that was the podcast that actually influenced Ryan to get into podcasting.
What?
We wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for these guys, maybe. Maybe.
No, probably not, because they were very encouraging. Especially Hugh, about the first podcast we ever released. And they said, hey, you know, keep going. This is some quality stuff. So keep going. Nice. Otherwise, they probably would have quit.
Oh, this is also touching. Retro Game Club Podcast just started their fourth season actually today. And they have released episode 112. We're on episode 4. So we got a ways to catch up. But we'll get there though. We'll get there. So definitely visit retrogameclub.net to check them out or follow the link in the show notes. And now let's move on to our main topic for the evening.
From Wired, video games already do what the metaverse just promises. Last month, the New York Times wrote about something that was hardly new or newsworthy, a wedding in the metaverse. Instead of a church or hall, their wedding took place in the metaverse, specifically an unknown lo-fi virtual world called Verbella, an outgrowth of realty company XP World Holdings, which employs both halves of the couple. So let's be clear about one thing. There is no metaverse. At least not yet. No one really agrees on what a metaverse is, but averaging together the more credible definitions yields a persistent social cyberspace that intersects with the IRL economy and integrates with other online platforms. Right now, nothing is doing this at any notable scale. Instead, we have a couple of well-attended virtual worlds like Second Life, a handful of popular massively multiplayer online role-playing games like World of Warcraft, and a lot of tech companies salivating over a new way to brand their sprawl of digital products and services. Tech companies have discovered the benefits of characterizing a metaverse as a continuation of their own products or services. Meta, for example, has decided that virtual reality integration is important to a metaverse. And conveniently, its Horizon Worlds runs on the company's Oculus Quest headset. Then there are the blockchain companies preaching the essentiality of their own coins to their own cyberspaces. Now, after almost a year of hype, it has become marginally easier to separate meat from metaverse fat. What we're dealing with here is cyberspace, connected, incarnated, and economized. There's still just one problem. Everything actually desirable about this metaverse resembles a pared-down version of the online games millions have been playing for decades.
It's been 20 years since wedding bells first rang in Second Life. Game developer Square Enix included mechanics for sending out invitations, composing vows, and exchanging rings in its 2002 Final Fantasy XI. Outside nuptials, online games already provide the most compelling functions associated with the metaverse, often with greater graphic fidelity, more complex social systems, and at a significantly larger scale. What are Decentraland or Horizon Worlds giving us that Second Life did not? More barriers to entry, it seems. To access Horizon Worlds, user must purchase a $300 Oculus headset from Meta. In Decentraland, users need crypto wallets for the game's proprietary ERC-20 coin. And in most popular experience, avatars mill around in a low-poly field next to a coin cart selling the proprietary cryptocurrency.
Woo! Even if video games do start looking more like metaverses and vice versa, it will still be a long time before even the most advanced virtual worlds reach any kind of Snow Crashian level of functionality or usefulness. For a metaverse to be truly interoperable, change-leading companies like Meta will have to work with other technology companies like Epic Games or Square Enix to stitch together their platforms and services. This seems unlikely, considering the past decades have shown tech companies are more inclined to consolidate than cooperate. It worked when big fish like Meta, then Facebook, were buying smaller ones like Oculus, but getting all the big fish into one happy pond seems doubtful and would produce a whole new set of problems. The things that make the promise of a metaverse intriguing, for the most part, already exist in online games, and much of what remains of that promise is unappealing, impossible, or greedy. That's why over the last year plus of lockdown, not one existing virtual world has been in a position to capture corporate meetings and e-commerce. Online games, in the meantime, bloated to accommodate a baser and more prevalent desire to be together and relate as people, not as workers or consumers.
So before we start talking about this, I have one question for you. Have you started calling it Meta, or is it still Facebook to you?
It's still Facebook. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Meta is a stupid name.
Can I friend you on Meta?
I'm reminded of the movie Coming to America where the guy's like, if they want to be called Meta, you should respect their wishes and call them Meta.
God damn it, this is a free country. If he wants to be known as Muhammad Ali, I'll be calling him Muhammad Ali.
That was perfect. Spot on. We might get DMCA'd for that because it was so good.
What? No way.
It was pretty good. I'll give you that.
Thank you.
All right. So it's talking about the fact that obviously we aren't where we want to be in this space when it comes to the metaverse. What are your guys' thoughts on this?
I don't know if it's not that we're not where we want to be. It seems to me that they're trying to shove something down our throats that we never asked for.
Right.
Right.
Kind of like NFTs, but isn't it funny how this goes hand in hand?
Do we really even need the Oasis? Does the collective people want the Oasis?
I do. Admittedly.
I think the idea of the Oasis is great. You know, a place you mm-hmm. can go in. It's a hub for you to visit with friends and actually interact with them. But what does that do eventually for your real life persona? Mm-hmm. Because we know there are addictions to feed, like the Jewel song says, and people can and do get evicted or not evicted, get addicted to video games. So if your real personal life is not what it should be or what you want to be, the easy escape is to put on that that headset and go into your Oasis, so to speak. And that, I think, can be detrimental to society.
I agree in that sense that, you know, this is something that will, that has the potential and the likelihood to become something that's addicting. The other side of that, that I think of though, from that point of view is, you know, often in real life, there's certain things that people have to deal with that they would be able to avoid in that space. So for example, let's say you're somebody who recognizes that you're somebody, say, that's trans and you don't feel comfortable kind of coming out to your family or you're struggling to find a group of friends, essentially what you could do is create an avatar and be able to feel more comfortable in your own skin.
Right. And I didn't think about the topic that you just touched on. That is one of the good things about this, is that it gives you an avenue to open up and be yourself, be who you really want to be true to yourself.
Mm-hmm. But I think the thing to keep in mind about all this is that none of the companies interested in the metaverse care about that.
No,
that's a good point.
1 ounce. That's not why they're making the metaverse. That's not what their plans are for the metaverse. Their plans are to get every single penny out of us that they can, whether we want to or not, by somehow convincing us to buy all these services that will be associated with the metaverse that we're perfectly fine with without now. Perhaps this is just my perspective because I'm super old, but I mean, like, to me, this just kind of seems like a joke. I don't know how else you can take it. Like, they really think that we are going to live and work and marry and do all these things in the metaverse and ignore what they call the meatverse, the real life. I mean, yeah, that's the stuff out of books like Snow Crash and Ready Player One, but I'll believe it when I see it, but I also kind of hope that all this hullabaloo around the metaverse and all these big plans and all this marketing, and they're already counting their money even before the metaverse is a thing yet. They're deciding how much they're going to get out of us. And I hope the whole thing just turns into a giant dumpster fire that, like, 5 years from now, we're all laughing about, remember when they were going to do the metaverse?
Meta will become a meme.
Yep.
Hopefully.
Well, it's already kind of a meme, but.
And if you think about it too, like, again, back to Ready Player One, that whole universe was created by a bunch of guys who were game developers and passionate about gaming. And this version is created by
by Facebook, yeah. The most transparent and moral company that has ever been.
Truth.
So we will basically never get the Oasis that we want.
Right.
We'll just get.
Not if Zuckerberg is the one doing it, or any of these. It's never going to happen unless online worlds can cooperate with each other.
Until the corporate wars, in which they start to...
and then we're only left with Taco Bell.
Exactly. You took the words out of my mouth.
Wow. All right. Well, let's move on from the metaverse, looking in the future, to the past. Class is now in session with Professor Rybread.
All right, thank you for coming, students. Please take your seats. Welcome back to Professor Rybread's Gaming History 101. And today's lesson is how Nintendo inadvertently helped create a competitor that has turned into one of the largest gaming companies in the world. And I'm, of course, talking about the Super NES CD-ROM, or many of you may know it, the Nintendo PlayStation. So, you know, one of the interesting arguments that I heard growing up is kind of a veteran, if you will, of the Sega Nintendo console wars of the 90s. I would hear fanboys say for Nintendo, like, well, Nintendo would never be dumb enough to make a CD add-on for the Super Nintendo. I've heard that 100 times.
I did not hear that on the playground. Wow. The console wars were different than I remember.
I may have said it. I don't know. Whatever. But the interesting part is that they were actually looking to kind of undermine the Sega / Mega CD. But the truth is that Nintendo was developing one in partnership with Sony even before the Nintendo or Super Nintendo was released. So take that, Super Nintendo fanboys, even if I'm one of them.
Wow.
So the question is, why cover this? So for one, at the time, Nintendo was king of the marketplace, and through poor business practice actually ended up leading to kind of their fall from grace, if you will. And Sony in the 80s had absolutely no interest in getting into the video game market, and this obviously changed quite a bit of it. This story isn't just speculation or legend. There is a prototype out there of the standalone Nintendo PlayStation that has recently surfaced a couple years ago. So this is real, folks. But just bear in mind that all the research that has been done for this is based off of internet research, a lot of Wikipedia, a lot of NintendoLife.com. So if I didn't get it right, please do not sue me. Thank you. All right, so if we start at the beginning, it starts with Sony engineer Ken Kataragi, who first became interested in working on video games when he witnessed his daughter, and she owned her own Nintendo Famicom system. So he saw the interest that she had in it and the addictive nature to it. So he started to push to drive a project which would develop the audio system for the Super Nintendo. He said, hey, let's get into this. This is a good market. Look how well it's selling. Now, at Sony, it wasn't exactly a popular project, and it likely wouldn't have seen the light of day if it weren't for the support of executive Norori Oga, who is credited with spurring the development for the compact disc. So, guy knew what he was doing. But without his help, this probably would have never come to fruition. So, he saw the value of it and continued to push for the project to get out the ground. So, come to find out, though, that the project was so successful that it actually opened up talks and an eventual partnership with Nintendo for Sony to develop the CD-ROM add-on for the Super Nintendo that would both play SNES carts as well as Sony's proprietary format called Super Discs, which I had, was unfamiliar with. Yeah. Love this. Everyone likes to add the word super to something, so especially back in the 90s. You know, partnering with other companies, though, at the time is not something that was new for Nintendo, as they had previously worked with Sharp to create the Twin Famicom as well as the Sharp Nintendo Television, which the latter was actually released in North America in the late 80s. Donnie, have you ever run across either a Twin Famicom or a Sharp Nintendo TV?
Yes, my aunt actually had a Sharp Nintendo TV.
No kidding. Wow. That's awesome.
Yes, when I was a kid. I have very fond memories of it. And right about the time that I kind of started my retro game collecting, that was one of the first things that I thought about, but I knew that that thing had gone. It was long gone by then.
Can we get a little playing of taps for that?
I'm pouring a virtual 40 out right now for it.
There you go. So for those of you who don't know, Twin Famicom was a system that would allow you to play Famicom cart and Famicom disc system games. So it was all in one. Sharp Nintendo TV was a television with a built-in NES or a Famicom in it. So kind of cool stuff. So in 1988, development for the add-on as well as a standalone system began, but it wasn't without its skeptics again. So from Nintendo's point of view, Sony had a little bit more control than they liked over the licensing agreement for the system, which leads to a whole bunch of extra drama that we'll get a chance to kind of cover here. But under the agreement for Sony, basically they would retain full control over the Super Disc format. So that was theirs. They owned the proprietary information for that so that they would, you know, sell that to developers and publishing companies. Which was kind of counter to Nintendo's business model at the time. Nintendo at the time would actually sign agreements with game publishers for a set number of carts per year that they had to buy straight from Nintendo. So in a way, you were kind of forced to buy the technology that they were used. So they were making money at the before you started selling the game and then when you sold it with them. So as well, they also had to pass these quality tests before earning the official seal of approval, which I question sometimes what games actually did pass that seal of approval, but I digress. But lastly, they would actually limit how many games your company could release each year under their name. So it was five. You could only release five under your name, which actually forced companies to create shell corporations to release more games. A popular example of that is with Konami, releasing games under the Ultra name in North America or the Palcon name in Europe. So if you've got a Palcon or an Ultra game, that's actually Konami, and it's because they couldn't sell under the Konami name.
Wow.
Which Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, the arcade, is, if I remember right, is an Ultra game.
It is an Ultra game. Yes, it is.
Yep. So with Sony under the agreement, they would be the sole benefactor of the licensing related to music, movie, software. Similar to what Nintendo was doing with other providers, they were kind of taking control, right, over that entire process. So they would have all of those rights available to them, which Nintendo president Hiroshi Yamauchi was already kind of weary at Sony at that point. And he looked at the contract and said, this is unacceptable. Like, we can't do this. So as Sony was the sole provider of the audio chip used in the Super Nintendo and required developers to pay for an expensive development tool with Sony, that also kind of turned off Nintendo because they were renowned for their development tools being fairly inexpensive, so smaller companies could, you know, work with them as long as they got permission from Nintendo. So Yamauchi did something very interesting. So he decided that the partnership with Sony was something that he wanted more control over. So he did a little bit of shady dealing in the background, if you will. And ended
scandalous.
Up yes, trying to create a partnership with Sony's biggest competitor in the marketplace, which is Philips. So he actually sent Minoru Arakawa and Howard Lincoln to the Netherlands to say, hey, Philips, if you work with us, we'll provide or we'll do the CD add-on with you, is almost like kind of a way to bluff out Sony for that. And Sony wasn't having it. But the interesting part is that in the book by David Shelf, which chronicles kind of this entire experience, he was quoted as saying the Philips deal was meant to do two things at once. Give Nintendo back its stranglehold on software and gracefully f*** Sony.
Wow.
Yes. Yes. So sadly for Nintendo, the failure of the Sega CD essentially killed the project. And overall, they saw it and went, no, we don't want any of this. Really, the only remaining remnants of the partnership was the failed CDI console with Philips. The problem, though, with this is that Nintendo essentially gave Sony a roadmap into getting to the video game marketplace. And with all this time and investment underway, it was kind of a no-brainer for Sony to say, hey, it's time to sell our own console. And if we look at it, that's where they ended up. They became the biggest company as far as video games are concerned, especially from a console standpoint. The PS1 was extremely popular. PS2 even more popular than that, and PS4 and PS5 have also been extremely popular as well. So they've led the marketplace for all those consoles. PS3 got overtaken, I think, a little bit by the Xbox 360, but for the most part, Sony has been in the driver's seat when it comes to the video game industry ever since.
Now, be careful when you say PS1, because most people contribute the PS1
right,
as the,
it's different.
The mini white...
Right.
Yeah, the one with, I think the one with the flip-up LCD screen or what have you, or maybe even just like the smaller, more compact version of the PlayStation. The gray one, they say it's the PlayStation.
Yeah, we don't want to get the actually police all over us.
Right.
Well, actually. Fair enough. I've heard it called the PSX, but that's also something different too. So
that is, yes.
Yep. But I appreciate it. I appreciate you making sure that...
We're looking out for you.
You're welcome. I got your dog.
I appreciate it. So let's actually take a look at some of the numbers that came out as a result of this partnership. So for one, Sony's new console, the PlayStation, would release first versus Nintendo's eventual release of the N64, which would be its main competitor. It was released in December of 94 and 1.5 years before the next gen console, which, of course, like I said, is the N64. PlayStation essentially crushed the numbers when it comes to the N64. PlayStation sold 102 million units and the N64 sold a meager 32.9 worldwide. Mm-hmm. So if we look at the prototype, though, I think that's one of the more interesting parts of this history. There were at least 300 prototypes for the Nintendo PlayStation. So think about this. It's a standalone Nintendo PlayStation console. So it would play both PlayStation games. So there was a front spot that you would put the CDs in, and then in the back was a cartridge slot, so you could put Super Nintendo games in, similar to the way the Sega CD was, that there were plans for games that would use both or what have you. So that was a big push for them, but they originally created these prototypes as an opportunity to kind of see how it would look and how it would play, but all of them were thought to be destroyed. So that was a thing, but in 2015, one service surfaced into the public eye. The owner of it, prior to its recent sale, was bringing it around to a bunch of conventions. I think it was actually at the PRGE convention that you went to, Donnie.
I'm not sure if it was at the PRGE one. I know it was at the Mo Game Con that I went to a couple years ago in 2019. Mm-hmm. It was there. There you go. I saw it. I have a picture of it, actually.
Obligatory. It belongs in a museum reference.
So do you.
Well, the interesting part is if we cover in just a moment, you will be happy to hear.
Okay.
So, it surfaced in 2015, but that's not when it was purchased. It was actually purchased by an employee of the company Advanta as part of their bankruptcy auction in 2009. So they were selling off a bunch of property. Apparently, one of the owners of Advanta got their hands on it, and it became company property. But in 2020, the prototype was sold to Greg McLemore, founder of Pets.com, for $360,000. And he plans to establish a museum for this type of hardware. So it will be in a museum. But summation of this, kind of the lesson for today, is for one, always read your contracts before you sign them. Nintendo, tisk tisk on that one. And shady business tactics might have a tendency to have a double-edged sword. So
yes, there were consequences. Nintendo has a Grendel now. Like, if you remember the story Beowulf, there's now a monster as a direct result of Nintendo's missteps.
Yep. And that monster is sitting at the top, if I'm not mistaken.
What?
he's taken over the hall. it's an ugly it's an ugly experience.
What are you guys talking about?
What?
Oh,
where are you going with that? I'm saying the Zelda CDI games.
Oh, no, I thought we're just talking about like PlayStation as a general is on top of the video game world right now with Nintendo.
That's
I see
entirely.
What you're saying is Grendel, because Grendel was such a deformed, nasty version of, got it. Okay. Now I get the reference.
I'm trying to bring some literary credibility to the podcast and it is not working. The point is, because Nintendo did this, is why the horrible Zelda CDI games exist.
Oof.
And they are, you're being nice by calling them horrible, I'll say.
Yeah.
Donnie, don't you have a CDI?
No, I do not. I would love to.
You got a 3DO then?
I do. I have two versions of the 3DO, the Panasonic 3DO and the Gold Star. I would love to have a CDI. I'm not on the up and up about the library, but I wouldn't mind having one.
So plumbers don't wear ties.
That's also for the 3DO.
Oh, is it? Okay. Yep. Then, the Flowers of Robert Mapplethorpe is 3DO then too.
I'm not sure about that one. I think it is.
Yeah, I think it is. It's you get to go through a museum of flowers.
Fun and riveting.
Right.
I give up.
All right. Well, thank you all for taking the time to attend another Gaming History 101. Just as a reminder, if you do have ideas for stories and you'd like to hear them here on the podcast, send us a message at gamersweekpodcast.com and we might feature your suggestion.
All right. Well, thank you, Professor Rybread. And let's go ahead and wrap up this episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening to episode 4 of Gamers Week podcast. And a great big thank you to the Retro Game Club podcast for sponsoring this episode. Be sure to check out their links in our show notes. If you want to connect with Gamers Week, follow us on Twitter at Gamers Week PC. You can also email us at gamersweekpodcast@gmail.com. Check us out on Twitch at twitch.tv/gamersweekpodcast. Support us on Patreon at patreon.com/gamersweek. And a big new announcement, we have a merch store. Woo!
Yeah, baby.
Visit gamers-week-podcast.creator-spring.com. Or if you want to do it the easy way, follow the link in the show notes. And finally, since you've made it all the way to the end of this episode, please leave us a review. Let us know how we did. We really do want to know. And while you're there, consider subscribing on iTunes or your podcast platform of choice. That's it for us tonight. Thank you, everyone, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you. Good night.
I thought you were about ready to pull an Evan Baxter.
Definitely keep that in.
Whatever.